The Dolo White Podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. Follow Cinema Anywhere Nashville on Instagram and book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience today. Hey, it's Dolo White, and this is the Dolo White Podcast. Obviously, this episode was supposed to come out last week, but I was sick. My wife was sick. My child had 2 days off of school, and oh yeah, we had an election. I just couldn't get it out, but here we are. My guest today is Steve Phillips, author of How We Win the Civil War. And some of you may be thinking that the Civil War ended in 1865, and I can totally see how you think that, but Steve Phillips offers a different perspective. And you know what? He's kind of not wrong. So let's get it started. Welcome to the Dolo White Podcast.
Polo Giddy. Live.
Yeah. What's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
Right here.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolo White Podcast.
All right, here we go. Episode 92 now of the Dolo White Podcast. My guest today, author of the new book, How We Win the Civil War, Steve Phillips. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I think for most people, they would say that we won the Civil War, almost 200 years ago to 150 years ago. Obviously, I think one side of the aisle, the side that you and I are on, can definitely see that there is still a lot of issues when the other one is still in denial. Do you think that the people that are there at the top making those in the right wing at the top, do you think they know what they're doing? Or do you think they've just been taught to them so much that's the way things are?
Oh, I think they know. And I would say there's probably those of us on one side know and understand. There's those on the other side who know exactly what they're doing. And that there are some in the middle who are in denial. And so in some ways, that's kind of why I'm trying to write the book for, is to get people out of denial. But it's very clearly Donald Trump's power in this country comes from being the champion of white people. And that I didn't even really realize recently until I was researching this for a column I wrote in The Guardian. He was at 4% of the polls before he got into the campaign, started attacking Mexicans,
yeah,
and sending the message that he was going to defend this country and white people from dark skinned people coming over the border. Then he zoomed up in the polls and it never looked back. And he's been a very direct and like Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a piece about a country's first white president, saying that whiteness is the essence of his power. So this whole thing, the immigration reform, the wall, is about, this is a white country. We're not letting anybody else in here. So he knows exactly what he's doing. His supporters around him know exactly what they're doing. And there, it's a quite cynical and calculated attempt to fan the flames of white racial resentment for their own political power.
I think what's crazy about it to me is it's obvious, I guess, to me to see, but I have family members who either don't see it or don't want to see it. I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to tell which one it is, but they're all dog whistles. I think people got so used to what racism was in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Exactly.
And when you say something racist, they expect it to be that.
Right.
But it's kind of the same thing, just without the ugly terminology, right? Like it's just,
right,
it's the same thing without the names.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the dog whistles is very much the right thing. It was Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote this piece saying, who does a guy have to lynch around here to get called a racist? Mm. Even the racists don't want to embrace that phrase as, oh no, it's not this, it's et cetera. But they're very much appealing to the same fundamental fears of white people, that the country is changing and you should be afraid of that. And so that's very consistent from the 1712 slave laws that said you had to restrain the barbarous nature of black people, to the Civil War, all the way up to this whole, you know, anti-immigration. And they always talk about immigration from Mexico, not from Canada. Nobody's worried, right, about people coming over the border from there. Worry about these dark-skinned people there. And this whole crazy, you know, critical race theory piece is that they're going to change what's taught in the schools. And so there's a fundamental through line of fear and trying to whip up greater fear among whites through whatever types of coded language that they can use, and sometimes not so coded.
And so your point that you make in the book, or one of the many points that you make in the book, is one, Democrats need to be more aggressive. But I think before we even get there with it, there's the timeline of the Civil War never ended. It just morphed into something different. So it went from you know, slavery to Jim Crow, to the Southern strategy, to like what you said, immigration today. And there are some that you can clearly see that timeline if you look.
Right.
And I think the struggle is getting people to look.
Yeah, no, it's denial is a strong force. They would like for this dust not to be in this battle.
Right.
They would like to just kind of go about their day and, you know, watch whatever sporting events and not be distracted by all of this stuff. But the point of what I was trying to write in this book is that we all want that. That's what we want to get to. But we are under unrelenting assault. And so the things that we have, our ability to be, you know, safe from the police, our ability to make any kind of progress, to have equal opportunity in terms of, you know, jobs and housing, are all under regular assault. And that this remains this fight around, is this country primarily for white people, or is it in fact a multiracial democracy? And if we don't recognize it, we're going to have things taken away from us.
I think the craziest thing for me is I have family that dirt poor family that will vote against their own interest because they've been dog whistled to racially, which to me is like, I don't get it. Like, it makes no sense to me. Like, well, you can have healthcare.
Obama got 96% of the black vote. And I was always like, who are those 4%? Right. Who actually didn't want to be
Kanye West, I guess.
Right. So you had that, you know, Malcolm talked about house Negroes and field Negroes. People have identified or been fearful of going with. And I can only imagine, you know, it's this interview is like about putting myself in the mind space of the different time period. I'm sure when Harriet Tubman says time to go, some people are like, well, I don't know if I want to head out. I'm safe here in the, you know, plantation. So there are always going to be people who are, you know, not getting it and not moving on the right side. But I don't think we can there's too much work to be done to be worried about trying to change their minds when there are others who are with us but need some help getting into the fight.
So let's move on. When Democrats do get control, they seem to always play nice. One of the things that Joe Biden said when he was running was, I can reach across the aisle and I can work with... We're not there anymore. And we haven't been there in a long time. And I think Republicans knew that. They've known that for quite some time. They've been working on these same things that they're doing now for decades. Why is it so hard for Democratic leadership to understand that?
Well, because I think they're behind the times and they're still operating on an old framework around what politics. I mean, historically, politics in this country is a battle between white people. You had progressive whites battling with conservative whites over the whites in the middle. And there weren't enough people of color to be that meaningful in election outcomes. In the 60s, people of color were 12% of the population. We're now 40% of the population.
Wow.
So people of color, the majority of people of color, with the meaningful minority of progressive whites, that's the majority of people. That's what elected Obama and reelected Obama. But a lot of the Democratic consultants and strategists have not caught up with that. And that's the difference between someone like Stacey Abrams, who that's the fundamental work she's been doing to expand the electorate, get more people of color to vote. And then the traditional Democratic consultants who only focus on TV ads, trying to persuade whites in the middle. And so my Georgia chapter is titled Georgia, That's Not One We Expected, which is what Biden said on election night as he was looking at the election results, because they didn't believe and understand what Stacey was doing to transform the electorate. So many of the people who control the resources and the direction, the priorities in the Democratic Party are frankly behind the times and don't understand the potential of inspiring and organizing and mobilizing voters of color.
Is that one of the reasons why not much gets done? Obama ran on basically universal health care and could have done it, but wanted to reach across the aisle, and it didn't get done. And Obamacare got done, but universal did not. And so I feel like when Democrats reach where they're trying to go, and I should use Obama as an example, but there are tons of other examples. They don't deliver on those same promises.
Right. And you're right. Because there is this faulty notion that you can. And I imagine if you wake up in the morning and think that I could be president of the United States of America, that you must also think you can get anybody to come over and agree with you. Right? So there's a level of that, you know, confidence.
The ego. Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
But I will say and I was a big part of my frustration with Biden in the first, you know, year, is they was not fighting back in the voter suppression piece, trying to do the bipartisan deals. But I more recently, they seem to have come, you know, gotten religion on this matter, doing that speech, calling out the, you know, Trump and the MAGA Republicans, the battle for the soul of our nation, leaning into the debt relief, the student loan debt relief piece, which they didn't, were not initially inclined to do. But then they saw that they had to be bolder and stronger to deliver, to inspire people of color and young people. So we're making some incremental steps in that direction, but it's still not as aggressive and forceful as it needs to be.
I never understood why Democrats didn't. I think 10 years ago, they should have taken weed and been like, this is our thing, because this is the one thing you can get people in, you know, in those very rural towns, you can get you can get them with weed. You can say, look, all this land you have, you can grow weed and you can make a lot of money doing it. You can smoke it and it won't be any issues. You can do a lot with weed. And they never did. And until now, I mean, Biden's doing what he did a couple weeks ago with those that are incarcerated for it. But I just thought that weed is easy. It's
the fear thing that we were talking about. They're afraid they're going to alienate somebody, or, you know, it's going to somebody, you know, suburban mom somewhere is going to be all like, oh, well, that means you're not, you know, have good values or whatnot. So that fear has inhibited Democrats far more than the Republicans have been. They're not fearful of anything. So that's what, you know, propels them forward.
They got Roe versus Wade overturned. I mean, I don't even know that they thought that they could get that done, and they got it done. So,
right. Well, that's what Trump has shown, is that if you just keep barreling forward, that you're not going to play a political price. And so Democrats need to learn that lesson on the other side. If you push the progressive agenda, push an agenda that benefits the majority of people, whether it's weed or whether it's, you know, student loan debt relief, that people are going to respond.
You said 40% are now identified as people of color in this country. Where do you see that going over time? Before it's 50, 60, 70%.
Well, there's two parts about it. And this is really what I went into in, you know, detail in my first book, Brown is the New White, is around trying to deconstruct the composition of the new American majority. So as we were talking about, it's not all people of color, but it is the overwhelming majority of people of color. And it's also not all people of color against all whites. And there is a very consistent and meaningful minority of whites who've always sided with this being a multiracial country, from, you know, the Jefferson trying to write anti-slavery stuff into the Declaration of Independence, to the civil abolitionists, civil rights supporters, et cetera. And so, but that the composite, that coalition is growing. One of the things we showed in the first book is every single day, if you take births and deaths and legal immigration, 7,000 more people of color added to the population versus 1,000 whites every day. And so the trend is very irreversible in that regard. And so the leaning into and embracing the notion that this is a new multiracial electorate, and then directing your resources and your policies to inspire and organize that, is a winning strategy. And it's a winning strategy over the long term.
I can't verify that this is true, but I have seen that the reason for that the right wing wanted Roe versus Wade overturned was to have more white babies. Have you seen that?
Oh, I haven't seen that. I wouldn't doubt that some people are actually saying that, actually.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that's something you've seen. I always ask authors this when I have them on, because you're obviously extremely intelligent, educated, and you know about this. But when researching for this book, is there something that stuck out that maybe you didn't know that you kind of uncovered and were like, oh, wow, like I had no idea?
Well, I do think it has the thing I learned much more about was the actual Civil War and how it began, and then also how it didn't end, are things I didn't fully appreciate. And so I didn't realize, as much as I, you know, better understand now, the Civil War began when the losing side in the presidential election, the side that was, when you have a president who was elected and that was the person that black people wanted, which was what Lincoln was, the other side refused to accept the results. Ooh. That's the genesis of the Civil War. Rather than accept Lincoln's election, they seceded from the Union and created the Confederacy. And then that came into conflict, and that became the armed conflict. And so the parallels to this moment, I didn't even fully appreciate. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece about the assassination of Lincoln is that I knew he was assassinated. Everybody knows he was assassinated. I didn't realize it was 5 days after the supposed surrender at Appomattox. And John Wilkes Booth, to Lincoln's election, represents N-word citizenship. That's the last speech he'll ever give. And he went and actually killed him. So those elements around how the Civil War began and how it is, in fact, never stopped, I didn't fully appreciate until I really dug into the facts and the research of this.
Steve Phillips, man, thank you for joining me. I love the work you're doing. How We Win the Civil War is available right now, correct?
Yep.
All right. Thank you so much. And hopefully next time you have a book, come back through.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
All right, man. Have a great one. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. You can book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience right now, starting at only $350. Cinema Anywhere Nashville provides your choice of a 16, 24, 36, or even a 100-foot screen plus projector setup and sound system. This is a super dope service that wouldn't just be great for corporate and work events, but also birthday and holiday parties, or if you want to have a romantic evening with your significant other, Cinema Anywhere Nashville is perfect for all of those things. They have the right experience for you. Follow them on Instagram right now at Cinema Anywhere Nashville and book your cinema experience today. I want to say thank you once again to my guest, Steve Phillips. Check out his book, How We Win the Civil War, available right now, all right? Brand new episode drops not next week, the week after. Obviously, next week is a holiday, so I'll be back on the 30th with Carla Naumburg. She wrote a book telling you that you're not a shitty parent, and she's probably right, but there's always a chance that you are a shitty parent. So we'll take a look into that in the next episode, dropping in 2 weeks. As always, make sure you follow me everywhere, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, everything, at DolaWhite101, D-O-L-E-W-I-T-E 101. And no matter what platform you're currently listening to this podcast on, make sure that you subscribe, follow, and rate and review and say nice things and give me 5 stars or 5, whatever they have, or 10, or I don't know what platform you're listening on, but just make me out to be something nice. I definitely appreciate that. I'm a Leo. I love the love. I love the attention. I love the positive feedback. Anyway, that's my time back in 2 weeks. Thank you for checking out the pod.